Loading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. You know, some days it feels like all you can do is watch worlds burn, or drown, as the case may be. This is especially true for those of us who live in the path of a hypercane. What's a hypercane? I'm so glad you asked. In a frighteningly possible future, you'll be hearing more about them. As the planet warms and the climate changes, we're in for all kinds of new and bizarre extreme weather systems. So hypercane is a hurricane so big and so powerful it extends through several states. Well, today on Cyber, we've got something special. Another short story from Motherboard's first book, Terraform. With me today on the show is one of the book's editors, Brian Merchant, and special guest Eric Holthouse. Holthouse is a meteorologist, a climate journalist, and the founder of Currently, a weather service built for the folks on the front line of the climate emergency. He's here with us today to read a bit from his Terraform story, Hypercane. Eric?
The National Weather Service has issued a hypercane warning from Ocean City, Maryland, Montauk, Long Island, effective until 8 p.m. Sunday. The radio crackled to life in the cab of the big Ford Super Duty EV. It was silent, just as well. Mariana preferred to ride in quiet as the self-driving truck did its thing. And though she'd long been fascinated with the weather, she felt herself tuning out as the automated warning was broadcast through the sound system. At first, in the early 2030s, the new hypercane designation for super strong Category 5 hurricanes riddled her with fear each time one approached the coast. This time, the hype surrounding this storm was just annoying. She had work to do. And of course, she was headed inland anyway. The state police had reversed the direction of the eastbound lanes of Interstate 70, like they always do for these sorts of storms. And she was joined on the highway by a convoy of vehicles of all shapes and sizes, mostly families from the Baltimore suburbs, the foothills of the Appalachians and Western Maryland, where the fast-growing cities of Frederick and Hagerstown welcomed them with open arms. Every time a hurricane like this hit, fewer and fewer of the storm-weary coasties decided to make the return trip. Mariana glanced to the left and then pressed her forehead against the Ford side window. She could barely make out the grimy, hulking frame of the coal plant, the R. Paul Smith Power Station. The eerie and distinctive pale crimson glow of the plant's carbon scrubbers surrounded the complex in a mile-wide orb. She suddenly felt sick to her stomach, knowing that the next several hours could define the rest of her career. She'd heard from a colleague who was tracking a plant in Maine that, during a recent power failure, that something may be up with those scrubbers, designed and manufactured by EnviroCorp, to suck planet cooking carbon out of the sky. And now found outside of just about any major pollution source in the country. He told her he'd noticed some strange readings that may indicate a significant amount of carbon dioxide was actually escaping through EnviroCorp's carbon scrubbers. Strangely, she hadn't heard from him since. When the forecast for a rapidly intensifying hurricane first hit the news wires on Tuesday, she'd enlisted a few dozen of her friends and coworkers, anyone she could trust, really, to see if they could help her find out more on the off chance any of the scrubbers lost power during the storm. Tonight, all across the Northeast, there'd be data collected near EnviroCorp scrubbers to see what exactly they were hiding.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, Eric. That was great. And one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because am I right that this is the first fiction story that you've published?
Right. It's true.
Right. It's the first work of fiction. And that's actually not, I mean, for some, I get fiction magazines, that would be strange, I guess. But a lot of folks that are in these pages are writing fiction for the first time, whether they're, you know, climatologists or meteorologists as yourself or tech journalists. So one thing that we did a lot over the years was try when we could to get folks who, you know, fiction wasn't their native language or their preferred medium to try their hand at this. And sometimes it just came out with just such stunning results, as in the case of this story, which, you know, it's kind of funny we're talking now because this is almost the 5-year anniversary of this story, which I think, if I remember right, we commissioned because it was the anniversary of Superstorm Sandy, I think.
That's right.
And I remember, you know, commissioning it and asking you to try to spin something up about this. And, you know, and we get a whole story. That's the whole thing. We get a whole sort of another lens. I mean, we can write a lot of, you know, op-eds about why this is bad, why we should be worried about, you know, the growing power of storms. But then you can, you know, really kind of see and feel it through this story. And on a lot of different levels, which we'll talk about, because yeah, we feel the urgency of the storm, but we also see sort of like the devastating short-sightedness of trying to address this problem in certain ways. So let's get into that. Can you put yourself back in the shoes of 2017, Eric, and talk a little bit about what you remember thinking about while you were coming up with sort of the genesis for this story?
Yeah, honestly, it was one of those moments where there, like you said, there's just so much more that's going on that you can't get your hand around emotions as well in you know, a like standard reported news story about a weather event. So, you know, all of these trends are happening now, and it's even more pronounced 7 years later. After Hurricane Sandy, we've seen in New York sort of like how the city mood has shifted, I would say. I was just back there last month, and yeah, there was still in the Rockaways, there was still sort of like notifications that were up about Sandy and like the you know, in the last minute had to be put in place to like reroute trains and all sorts of things that folks had to do, you know, with what resources they could in the spur of the moment. Those systems are still in place, right? Like they were not intended to last 7 years. So this is kind of that era of the climate emergency that we're in now is, obviously that happened to 100x degree, during COVID, where we all just like on the fly recreated new lives for ourselves, and tried to you know, take care of each other as best as we could. So even in the intro of this story, you know, there's this talks about basically like the permanent depopulation of the immediate East Coast, sort of like new social dynamic that's happening within Maryland as that is taking place. People are reacting to it. People are getting bored of it. If anything, you know, like what we would imagine, like mass displacement and chaos. I imagine, you know, the same thing sort of happened among me and my friends and family in now the 2.5 years after COVID. People get sick of, you know, like using hand sanitizer or using your mask, and then there's backlash just out of boredom sometimes. So yeah. All of these things are happening already, you know.
Yeah. And that's a memorable line. And this is like every time it happens, you know, which is, I think in the story, 3 years in a row, there's been this hypercane, you know, fewer people come back after they flee, which is a good way of summing it up, I think, because it's, you know, it is not these long-term sort of planning decisions or the sort of the adjustments to infrastructure that we need. And that's kind of what you're just speaking to just in your last answer. Instead, it's all these sort of band-aids, both on the solution side, which in this story take the form of sort of these high-tech scrubbers that are supposed to be pulling carbon out of the air, but the corporation never got around to actually installing the mechanism that would actually do that. They just like kind of emit this red glow and broadcast futurity.
Let's back up real quick, actually, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Can you define what a hypercane is for us?
Sure.
And give us the kind of the scientific basis for this thing coming around.
Sure. So my the thought is pretty real, actually. Inspired by Hurricane Sandy. So Sandy was one of those storms that defied expectation and defied definition. Even the National Weather Service, as it was making landfall, decided not to issue hurricane warnings because it wasn't technically a hurricane. It had a hybrid core and was deriving its energy directly from the jet stream rather than from warm ocean temperatures. So this is something that I imagined, and wind storms go through that what's called extratropical transition. It's a normal thing that storms do, but Sandy just didn't weaken at the surface very much during as it was going through that process. So Sandy ended up being the largest hurricane or tropical storm force storm on record in the North Atlantic. So it was almost 600 or 700 miles wide at the peak, which helped to create a larger storm surge at the coast. So imagine, if your arm is 3 feet long versus like only your elbow is just like 1 foot long, you can move a lot more water with a longer arm. So this is basically as a hurricane rotates, it is pushing water around in a circle, but pushing water in general towards the coast because the hurricane is moving towards the coast. So Hurricane Sandy just had a massive amount of leverage that it could push water towards the coast, which is why storm surges were so high in New York City and why the subways flooded. So I would imagine, and this is what the predictions are, is that the size and strength of these storms will just continue to grow over the coming decades. Hurricane Sandy was our first glimpse of a storm like that. So the idea with a hypercane is that you have a storm as large as Hurricane Sandy, but you have retained in that very intense inner core as well, 150 to 200 mile per hour winds at the core as well. So I it's not really beyond the realm of possibility for a storm like this to take place in the next couple decades.
Yeah, it's frightening. In the world, I guess we should have just set up this story from the onset. So this is a world maybe 20 years down the pike, 20 or 30 years down the pike. I don't think we get a hard date. We do learn that they've sort of been designated hypercanes in the 2030s after there's been enough of these sort of large scale events. There's self-driving cars and occasion, then these plants are automated. So we've had these incremental advancements in technology. And then the story follows sort of a hurricane survivor, right? Somebody whose family had lived through one of these disastrous hypercanes. And she has this intel that this company, and then after these hypercanes started, the Congress passed a bipartisan law that basically incentivized, carbon scrubbing or removal. It's one of these sort of five years ago, this seemed like maybe more of a viable, like kind of pre the sort of the wind behind the sails of things like the Green New Deal and other approaches. But for a long time, I think some listeners might have forgotten that like this, like carbon trading and carbon, like putting a price in carbon was kind of like the leading solution to, you know, on climate policy. And there was a lot of people who always thought it was a bad idea.
Gotta have market-based solutions, Brian.
That's right. Market-based. But you get market-based solutions, and then you get, which honestly, like when this story came in, I was like, oh, this is a fun story, fun depiction of this. I worried even then, is this like a little bit of like a fringe thing? Could we really have like a corporation that like lurches to power fueled by sort of this need for market-based solutions that is then scamming, you know, basically everyone by pretending that it's actually drawing carbon out. And then it's, and then since then we've had things like, you know, the Volkswagen scandal where they weren't really, you know, reducing emissions.
Exactly
the same thing happened. You had more people calling for you know, more sequestration, you know, instead of, so it's not, if anything, with like the passage of something like the Inflation Reduction Act that sort of bankrolls these like market-based solutions alongside some other stuff that we do need, I think it ends up that this is yet another speculation that is more prescient than we hoped it would be. Can I get, you know, ask, I know we talked about the Hypercane side. I want to ask you about like why sort of, you know, when we were talking about doing a story about, you know, about the rise of more powerful hurricanes and that element of sort of the climate crisis, why even then you sort of decided to sort of fix your story around this notion that, well, people are going to try to do something about it, but it's going to be like a corporate solution, and they're going to try to, you know, they're going to try to game the system and profit off it while doing nothing. What, you know, why was that your instinct? And do you still feel like it's a valid criticism?
Right. You know, I mean, and this part was inspired by the original sort of like 1990s, early 2000s, when it was, I guess, was never truly bipartisan, but I would imagine, you know, in both Bush presidents, there was this kind of idea of like, oh, we'll just pay people to, I mean, like hardcore market-based solution on climate. Like, we're not against climate action. We just need to make sure that it doesn't ever affect the bottom line of the oil industry, right? So there was this coal to natural gas switching that happened in the U.S. Where now, you know, coal industry was in the 80s and 90s like 70% of our source of electricity, and now it's natural gas that's like 60-70% of our source of electricity. And with that has basically come an increase in risk, because methane is 80 times more powerful than carbon dioxide on shorter time scales, which is the exact time scale that we have to solve this problem. You know, 5 to 20 years is about the time where we need to be getting down to 75% fewer carbon emissions in the U.S. Turns out that even a leakage rate of, you know, 1-2% of natural gas completely blows out all of the benefits of switching from coal to natural gas. So, and that has happened. Like, there's no monitoring in any effective way of these, you know, Permian Basin in Texas or North Dakota, or like basically anywhere where there's been fracking, there's just thousands and thousands of dead wells that are more than likely uncapped, not able to be tracked in any meaningful way. And so, you know, simultaneously over the last 15 years, we've had this surge in global methane concentrations. Now, there's new data out in the last month or so that says that most of that new additional methane is coming from the tropics and wetlands as they are being warmed by and land use changes as well in the tropics, which is like deforestation. But But along with the Arctic melting permafrost, the major source of emissions of methane in the world is leaking wells from the natural gas industry. So, so that has been that tried and failed market policy. And like, I'd imagine that that's like, if you're ever going to get that 51st vote in the Senate, the way the Senate is currently structured, it's going to be a coal senator from West Virginia, you know, like it's going to be someone who has deep ties to the fossil fuel industry or lives in a red state where they have to like, you know, like that's all it feels like, unless there's radical changes in the structure of U.S. democracy, it's always going to be that way.
I have
the foreseeable future.
I have a fun anecdote for you that I think speaks to how all of this is being handled in some of these places. So I live in South Carolina now. I'm from Texas originally. Lived above the Barnett Shale in North Texas. In North Texas, you know, Ross Perot has a lot of money, spends a lot of money. There is a Perot Museum. It's a science museum. A lot of great stuff in there. There's an exhibit that is all about fracking and how amazing the Barnett Shale is. And it is aimed at kids. It has a cowboy, like, and there's an animated cowboy that sings and tells you about the miracle of fracking and how this is going to be great for us and great for the environment. And even a ride where you can take a drill down into the ground, like a virtual kind of thing, and like feel the rumble of the drill or the, I don't, technically not a drill, but you know what I mean? So just think it's interesting to see the places where the market is a little bit more unleashed and the way these companies are talking to people about these new technologies and their, you know, their market-based solutions.
Right. It is a fascinating technology and it has totally changed the world. I mean, it is amazing. Like, I would imagine that there has never been a technology like, where you have I don't have any hard numbers, but I imagine that it is now, it supports 60% of U.S. energy supply in a matter of, you know, 10 to 15 years. Like that transition from a technology that previously did not exist, like that's what has to happen in renewables. But we're growing, like, you know, renewables are growing faster than any other energy source right now. But they don't have without government support, they don't have the energy to completely displace, 60 to 70% of U.S. energy production in a matter of 5 years, right? Like, that's shocking how successful fracking has been. But it has been because of all the subsidies that they've really, and you know, like, a new fracking well is like a one-to-one a capital expenditure for amount of expected revenue. Like, those fracking wells die out every 3 to 4 years. They have to constantly be replaced. So it's just like a massive suck of capital and energy and land. And, if anyone has ever traveled through fracking country in the U.S., it has totally transformed the landscape almost permanently. I can't imagine how that land that receives little rainfall per year would transform in a human time scale back to something that's recognizable as land. Like, it just looks like a wasteland.
Yeah. The Texas Midlands will never be the same, you know? Mm.
Yeah. A lot of places won't.
All right. Cyber listeners, we're going to pause there for a break. We'll be right back after this.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right, cyber listeners, this is Matthew. Thank you for sticking around. We are back talking about Hypercane.
I mean, it is interesting. Like you said, it's a totally transformative technology. There's some degree of, and the reason that the extant fossil fuel industries liked it so much is because it had some degree of like interoperability with, and that's one reason it's sort of harder to get the solar and wind going. It's a completely new sort of supply chain and infrastructure, and where it's completely different. It's been around for a while. But I think one thing that you hit on this story when you're thinking of new technologies is here is, to me, reading it 5 years later, reading Hypercane, it's almost like a parable about sort of the dangers of believing or buying the hype from any corporation or any market-based solution wholesale. Because, again, like what this is, I think it's EnviroCore or some fun sort of like, you know, ominous sounding corporation that has sort of like captured this market. You won a bunch of government contracts, sold everybody on this like good thing. You mentioned that it's so important to them that they burnish this good image to the liberal elites that, you know, that they're they have all this confidence, but it's really just entirely a smokescreen. So it is, you know, it is basically, if they're, it's the epitome in a way of pitching a technological solution where there's no there, which in a lot of ways is, you know, you've been knee deep in sort of the green space for a long, long time. And since, you know, the entire century, this has been sort of the predominant mode, both on the liberal side, you know, and, you know, like solutions, you know, find the solutions. And there are some legitimate ones. Sure, renewable technology is, you know, is important and will get us there. But then all of these other things, to what extent, you know, do you think it is a danger in general of being told that, you know, technological solutionism, or there is a technological solution that is the core way to address the climate crisis? Obviously, it's got us it hasn't got us far yet, and has it left us in more danger than you know, more sort of grassroots? Yeah,
more nothing. Worse than doing nothing. Yeah. So direct analog here to the airline industry, which a couple of years ago created their first ever industry-wide carbon neutrality plan. They called it carbon neutral growth, which means like, you know, airline capacity is growing faster, or demand for air travel is by far the fastest growing source of carbon emissions. So still we're operating in a world where half of the people on Earth have never been on an airplane before. And so, you know, it's still relatively rare to have someone who flies more than once a year in the global population. So, in general, you know, people who travel a lot are folks who are wealthy and have some desire to know the rest of the world, either through business or through pleasure, right? So, so the airline industry is very well focused on, you know, catering to like green sensibilities of their customers. But almost all of their carbon neutrality plan is through offsets. And I don't know if anybody watched the John Oliver last week, or was it week before, but he talked about carbon offsets. And this is, it's just like the OG climate scam, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's just like, we'll pay someone to plant a tree on your behalf. In 30 years, if the tree survives, it will have sucked out the carbon emissions from your 1 hour flight. So you can imagine like the Ponzi scheme nature of this inherently. But I think that, yeah.
And it's always been that way too. I feel like there are like investigative reports. I remember reading a Harper's story about this like 15 years ago or something like that, something crazy 10 years ago. And it just didn't matter. It didn't put a dent in the armor of this sort of approach where it's like, well, this is all we can do, so we got to keep doing it. Like, we'll do it better. You know, we'll plant more trees or make sure that there's some sort of oversight program.
It's indulgence buying is what it is.
Exactly. Right.
you know, in the middle, the church, the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages knew that rich people were going to sin. They're going to feel bad about it. So they set up a system whereby rich people would come in, say they felt guilty, and give a bunch of money to the church. This is the same thing. It's people that know enough about the climate crisis to feel bad about their personal consumption habits paying a tithe to wash the sin away. That's what this is. That's what it's always been.
Yeah, so further empowering the fossil fuel. And Delta Airlines owns their own refinery in New Jersey. So, jet fuel is the number one expense of any airline company. So, without getting too far into carbon offsets as a technology, I mean, it's a brilliant technology, right? Like, it plays exactly on the needs, self-defined needs of someone who buys it. So, I think that, that's what the fossil fuel industry is doing, has been doing for, since climate became mainstream in the late 80s. I think that the fossil fuel industry has been manufacturing demand for fossil fuels in a way that they know that the game would be up eventually, right? Like, it's not going to work forever. And now it's carbon trading, and now it's offsets, and now it's like EVs instead of pedestrian-friendly technologies, right? Electric airplanes instead of or helicopters or something instead of, I don't know what they're coming up with, but instead of, building out a true rail and bus system in the U.S. that could actually meet our needs of the next 50 years. So, all of that's going to take a huge expenditure, but we somehow found the money in the 1950s to pay for the interstate highway system, right? Like, this could be that moment where we say, we're going to spend $2 trillion and fully build out passenger rail, buy out all the right-of-ways and all that stuff, and just make it happen. That would not pass in a bipartisan Senate right now, as we've seen. It's a matter of structural democratic reform, I think, is what it's going to take to make these technologies that actually can get us there are going to need some help from the federal government. And the only way to get that help is through structural democratic reform, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to take radical change in some ways. I mean, it's one thing to even build, although I think there are valid analogs there, like in LA, where they actually did tear up the light rail and then put roads in. We can tear up the roads and put the light rail back in if we were so incentivized. It is just, the hardest, as you well know, like all of these, structures that have all these sunk costs that have gotten quite accustomed to generating profits on a massive scale, that, whether it's, then it overlaps with the automobile industry and the fossil fuel industry, getting that, I think the lesson of the last 20 years is dangling a tiny carrot in front of them saying hey, you can make a little bit of money if you draw down carbon emissions, is never going to amount to more than a drop in the bucket. Even with these increasingly Byzantine financial, structures and incentives, we just haven't seen the, carbon offsets are, they get a few people yet maybe throw a few extra dollars when they're buying their flight. Maybe it, assuages some policymakers for a few years here and there, but it's pretty clear that it has not affected the bottom line in any meaningful way. So I think you're right. The only way is through more radical systems change. And I think what we were starting to get at with that, with the fact that you have this technology at the center of your story that is basically a distraction, or it's doing more harm than nothing, because it's giving people the impression that something is being done. And
they continue about your lives and continue consuming, right? That's the whole point.
Right. And that's the whole point. And that's the thing with that's something so tricky with the airline industry, because nothing short really of a policy change there, saying like, you can't do this at this scale anymore. Like, we just, we can't. I mean, as long as we have jet fuel at the, do you still not fly? I know.
I have transformed into one flight per year, and it's like a family reunion type of flight that where it seems like, you know, that something that is making my life sustainable on multiple dimensions rather than just being completely black and white about it. Like, I think that when
can you talk about that for just one sec, because I know at one point you made a decision not to fly at all.
Right. Yeah. So I think it was around 2013, 2014, when the previous IPCC report came out. I basically had this. And up until that point, I was definitely way more on like the tech and transform things and could be the leap we need. You know, like some massive uninvented technology could save us, you know, thinking in fantasy world a little bit. And I just had that sort of like pulled an all-nighter to do file my story on the IPCC report, and then just realized like it's like the radical social change at this point is the quote technology that we need, right? And I think that, you know, I couldn't justify anymore being a daily reporter on climate without doing the very basics on my own life to kind of think about that. The conversation has shifted. At the time, airline emissions were about 75% of my carbon budget. So, you know, if that's what we need to do is to radical reduction emissions in the span of less than a decade, then I could do that immediately, basically. I could cut my own emissions. And if everyone did that, of course, like that's, you know, that's not possible to just like enforce a black and white solution on people. And also it is dangerous to think about internalizing the harms of the fossil fuel industry, because then you get burnout among folks that really care, right? Like folks on the front lines of the climate emergency are not responsible for creating this problem.
Right.
At the same time, you know, we can reduce our own emissions, but also have our main source of energy go towards transformational change. Like, you can do both. You don't have to choose one or the other. So,
yeah,
that's kind of where my thought has evolved over the last 10 years or so on flying. I, you know, recently turned down a second family reunion flight this year. I didn't go because it was going to require a flight. So, and it hurts to not see your family, but also it hurts to know that you're participating in something that's damaging people who don't have ability to take those actions. So
I have a question from the audience. What are your feelings about wind solar tax credits? To my uninformed eye, they seem to operate at a scale that drives meaningful investment. And the Inflation Reduction Act changes seem poised to significantly increase construction. What say you?
Yeah, no, I think it sounds great. I mean, that's exactly what we need, is to shift subsidies from the fossil fuel industry to the renewable industry to have truly zero emission power sources. So the goal here is not net zero carbon emissions globally. The goal is zero carbon emissions globally. Any solution that gets us to zero carbon emissions globally is something that we should be working for, that works in line with justice, right? Well, that works in line with making sure that we are building an equitable society at the same time. So we cannot have solutions that further the inequality and the divide that the climate emergency has caused. We can and have to repair both of these problems at once with the same set of solutions.
Yeah, and I would add that I think your critique is not that like there are, it's not that there are no good technology and we should incentivize the things that have been proven to work and that in many cases are like a great thing for a community that can provide like stable employment and like, and can, if they're, you know, deployed and implemented well and fairly, especially, but yeah, like we know that, you know, solar works. We know that wind turbines work. There are caveats, of course, and supply chain issues and things, but we know that there are technologies that can do the right thing. But it's when you open up this space and you say, you know, technology will save us, or there's something that will deliver like a broad solution. You do crack the door for technologies that wind up either being outright, you know, scams or boondoggles. We have these huge carbon sequestration plants. We just have to be extremely suspicious. We have to interrogate the technologies that enter into these equations. And things like just fully incentivizing the removal of carbon dioxide, you know, and allowing all of these projects to do it. Like, there are some great carbon, you know, removal projects or carbon sinks. There are things that are good, but when you operate it on this purely for profit sort of schema, and you have like all of a sudden Goldman Sachs is in the business of trying to maximize its carbon offsets, you're going to wind up with a lot of, you know, poorly performing projects, fraud, and in some cases things that again work worse than if, as if it were nothing. I mean, the big old carbon sequestration plant that I think was it W that funded that back in the day? It was sunk billions of dollars into this carbon sequestration plant. And then even the plant's operators just had a op-ed in the Times that said like, no, doesn't work. Don't do this. Mm-hmm. This was a bad idea.
Brian, I've got a question for you actually. Can is here? So we've done, this would be the fourth one of these we've done, talking about Terraform. And it occurred to me reading Eric's piece that there is something that fiction can do when we're dealing with these big issues like climate change that to so many people are either abstract or feel completely overwhelming. There's something that fiction does that Terraform, I think, does that regular journalism cannot achieve, right? Can y'all talk about that and like how these stories personalize things that are happening all around us?
Yeah, like I said at the top, I think that it's the emotions that you get in fiction. That does, I mean, this is what has been missing from the climate debate for 30 years, is that it was pitched as a science and tech issue, and it is really a people issue, right? It's about who lives and who dies and where do they live and where you can travel and what you can eat. And like, nothing is more personal than climate. And I mean, climate is literally like the definition of environment, right? Is the earth. It's everything that we know. It's everything that we are. So, you know, tapping into the guilt and shame and fear and anxiety and everything that people are feeling right now around climate, that like even in climate spaces, it's kind of difficult to have these conversations. So like anyone that's going to go full force into these emotions is going to be sort of successful as a fiction writer, I think, because they're giving space to people to feel these things.
Yeah, I would say that's exactly right. I mean, and that's not done enough. I mean, famously, like our entertainment industrial complex has had a hard time figuring out, like, especially to do like, you know, big budget. It's getting there closer now. But look, when something like, you know, Don't Look Up comes along, it's a huge hit, because you can debate all day long whether or not it was a good or a great movie or whatever, but it just touched that nerve that like sort of universal feeling that people have about things going catastrophically wrong on this huge level and nobody seeming to be able to do anything about it in the you know, the halls of power. You could see how effective and how visceral the reaction to that was, and it was on a different level than, again, reading your op-eds or your climate reporting, which and I'm never going to pretend that like fiction is like does anything as important as just sort of like, you know, grassroots level organizing or community organizing or that, or, you know, on that level, that's always the first and most important thing is building power. But there is a conduit you can tap into that you don't, like Eric is saying, an access to sort of like to an emotional level, a space to sort of work through some of these possible futures in a way that isn't just looking at numbers on an IPCC report, a way to sort of compute and to sort of process this. And sometimes seeing a protagonist go through this or seeing an experiment, we've had just some really great things that have helped me personally. Debbie Urbanski wrote a great piece called An Incomplete List of Things We Tried, which someone who covers climate or used to cover climate more on a daily level, I've seen them all. I've seen up to a certain point when she goes into the future, you know, she works back. It's these things like turn off the lights when you leave a room. And then all of a sudden it's the extinction, you know, of trying to send generation ships out to the stars. You can trace a clear line and saying, oh, okay, this is a new way of communicating the fact that we are on a trajectory that is dangerous, and it can raise the hair on your back a little bit in a way that, you know, other things can't. We have got another great story called 1,000 Cranes that kind of tells the story of a family. It's maybe the most horrific story in the collection. They're fleeing sort of the new wildfires, and it's based on the story of someone who survived Hiroshima for a little while, and who sort of dealt with it by folding crane after crane after crane. It's about a woman who's folding cranes for her children who are choking from the wildfire smoke as they seek higher ground, and they're climate refugees. So there's ways of sort of that it just, you know, I think it's good, it's cathartic to sort of enter the fiction space, especially folks who can do it well. I think somebody who, you know, has the expertise on the science side, like you, Eric, and then saying like, well, this is how I am imagining one possible future, like step into my world for a while. It helps us sort of better relate to, you know, your body of work and to sort of, you know, what climate science is saying the future of, you know, hurricanes and perhaps hypercanes are. So yeah, I think it can do a lot if we let it. And I think it's the reason why we devoted a whole third of this volume to climate stories, basically. So the whole section Burn, the section in which, you know, this is Watch Worlds Burn. This is the third and final section, the section that Eric's story appears in, all sort of deal in one way with sort of the climate crisis and sort of exacerbating inequality. So yeah, I hope folks, you know, get some of that, any or all of that, out of spending some time with these stories and stories like Eric's.
I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. Yeah.
Do you have any other thoughts, Eric, or any final words?
I mean, my only thought is, you know, my personal trajectory since I wrote Hypercane, was I ended up writing my own book, The Future Earth, which kind of expands on a three decades look, the 2020s, 2030s, 2040s, about what path we could be on if we decided to do it, right? If we decided to say, like, you know, transformational social change is what the IPCC says we need. Transformational social change is what, you know, on the ground frontline organizers say we need. Let's can do it, right? Like let's put everything into it, and then, you know, even still we're gonna have these, you know, like escalating glacier collapses and like rapid sea level rise, like those, that stuff is baked in no matter what happens at this point. So as we are navigating the future, this was like a hybrid of fiction and nonfiction, this book ended up being. You know, it's set in the future, but it's very factual. Like, it is based entirely on peer-reviewed science. Like, nothing happens in the book that has not been, like, made possible through science. So that was kind of, that's an extension if you're looking for something else to read after reading Hypercane. My book, The Future Earth, is something That's a lot more on the inspiring side. And then I have a project that I started called Currently, which is more of a, what's it called?
It's a service or a tool.
Yeah, here and now, action-oriented way of making that world in the future Earth happen. So we right now have a network of dozens of cities around the U.S. I've assembled a group of meteorologists that are wanting to work in their communities to deliver weather information to folks in the front lines, folks that don't have English as their first language, and trying to build out what I think a weather service should be in the climate during the climate crisis. So we are focused every day on weather, just as your weather app does. We can provide sort of like personalized two-way interactive weather forecasts via SMS. And we also are building communities at the local level to sort of advocate for change. So that's currently HQ.com.
Yeah, and you can follow that on Twitter too. It's associated with Twitter, right? Yeah.
It's at currently on Twitter.
Okay. Yeah, and get the Future Earth. I just had my book. It disappeared under a pile here. But yeah, the Future Earth is great. It's really a fantastic book. I can't believe we talked about speculative fiction and climate change for an hour with that. Mentioning that before that point, because yeah, it is. It's a great example of using sort of both those strands and tying them together to make it more than a sum of its parts. I really recommend that book. Thanks.
You know what else you recommend?
This one?
Terraform.
Yeah.
If you want to read Eric's full story, Hypercane, you can find it in Terraform, as well as a bunch of other wonderful stories where you can watch worlds burn. I am Matthew Galt. Brian, thank you for coming on Cyber for all of these episodes. Claire Evans is your partner in this, fellow editor, also is here for three of them. Sad she's not here today. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Eric, thank you for coming on and giving us this reading and walking us through your story and the power of fiction and what we need to do about climate change. If you all are listening to this as a podcast, we did stream this live on Twitch, and you can watch it too at twitch.tv/motherboardtv. Follow us there and you'll be notified when we go live. Maybe catch the next live show and be able to get your questions in for the guest. We will be back a little bit later this week with another story about the horrifying present and possible future that we all live in. Goodbye, everybody.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.